Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's go back to, well, it's September 15th. So I just need to tell you that the University of Texas was opened on this day, the Austin campus, the first campus, in the middle of nowhere, I imagine, in this year. What year do you think the University of Texas was founded? It is, by the way, one of the two, three, or four biggest universities in the United States. There's about 50,000 people at UT Austin, and I have a number of friends that teach there. Give up. 1883, University of Texas was founded. It's nowhere near as old as some of the schools here on the East Coast, but that's understandable. And Muhammad Ali defeated Leon Spinks to win his third world heavyweight boxing title in this year. Guess. 1978. That's the thing, and I give Muhammad Ali all the credit in the world, not just for being a great boxer, but very few people can... Most people ride the media wave for all it's worth, and then when they get tossed off it and somebody else rides it, that's the way it is. They've made their money, they've made their fame, and they live with it. A few people grab the media tiger by the tail and make it move the way they want it to move. And Ali was as good as anyone at doing that. And so for that regard, as a star, he was in control of his own destiny in many ways. What's a shame is that he fought too many fights and ended up with brain damage. But the Leon Spinks fight, the second Spinks fight, should never have happened. And Muhammad Ali should never have won the crown three times because he should never have lost it to Leon Spinks in the first place. Leon Spinks was a fighter from St. Louis, where I was living at the time, and he was not really anybody to speak of. But he got this title fight because they didn't think Ali could lose. He wasn't in good enough shape. He got beat. And so he had to train harder, and he had underestimated his opponent. He set the bar too low, and he regained the title for the third time, the only man ever to do so. But it never should have happened. So enough about that and my rant about that. Let's go back to another heavyweight fight, the Obama-McCain bout. Because in the end, that's what it's going to come down to, is Obama versus McCain. And I think the Obama campaign is realizing that, and they are going to avoid, I think, getting sucked into any more of this nonsense with Sarah Palin. Palin's a big star. The Republicans love her. And while her resume is thin and there's evidence coming out now that she's being vetted by the media that she's not quite the reformer that the McCain campaign wants to sell her as, and she's not quite the effective mayor and anti-pork person that they tried to sell her as. The Obama campaign needs to leave that alone. Deal with it in ads if you want, but don't address it day by day, and certainly don't get sucked into conversations about whether or not a pig has enough lipstick. So I think they're going to do that now, and they're going to focus on the economy. You know, it was 92 when Bill Clinton put the sign over his campaigns on the campaign wall saying, "It's the economy, stupid," to remind him that every day his job was to hit George H.W. Bush on the economy. And the economy was nowhere near as bad as it is now. So it isn't a recession, but it feels to people like a recession. And Obama's out talking about that. Biden's out talking about that. McCain is even out talking about that now. So the question is, will the country buy that, yes, the party, we've got bad times, but trust the party that was in power during the bad times to deliver you out of the bad times? I don't think that'll work. You know, in 1980, Ronald Reagan said to America, ask yourself, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, meaning when Jimmy Carter took over? And of course the answer was no. We had inflation, we had a recession, we had the Iranian hostage crisis. The country was nowhere near better off. Right? And that same logic works today. So, and of course the third component here is gas prices. Although they've been dropping recently, which should help McCain slightly. Let's not forget, well, two things. First is that if you've noticed the way the gas prices have gone each time there's a rise, what happens is like they rose over $2 a year or so ago, and then when it receded to 150, people were like, oh, well, that's not so bad. But it had been 99 cents before that. So they go up 50%. We think that's not so bad because it had gone up 100 and then it receded. Same thing here. Now, I'm not much for conspiracy theories, but I have always been curious about this because gas went up to over $4 a gallon nationwide. We were paying $4.19 here at one point. I even paid $4.53 at one gas station once. And I'm thinking, holy cow, this is ridiculous. Then it started receding. It got down to $3.50, then $3.40, $3.35, whatever it was nationwide. I know what it was in my area. And people's attitude was kind of like, phew, at least it's not $4. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. It was $1.50, $2 not that long ago. It's up to $3.50 and we're happy? So there's a little bit of a psychological thing going on there that I don't know is intentional on the part of the powers that be, because like I say, I'm not much on conspiracy theories, but it is interesting how it always seems to work that way. It never just rises and stays there at its height, which is kind of what you might expect, is small rises and it always continually reaches new peaks, but it never really drops way back down, and it has several times. But the other piece about it is that right now, with Hurricane Ike wreaking havoc in the Gulf, it has really shut down oil refining. And so oil gasoline prices have gone up 17 cents in the last week per gallon. And there's no sign that they won't continue to rise. And I'm not talking about people that are being price gouged or the prices are rising down in the Gulf area in Texas and Louisiana where the hurricane damage is. I'm talking about nationwide. So fill up your tank today. For tomorrow, gas will be higher. So all of these issues work against the McCain campaign. Let me deal with one more economic issue, taxes. So here's the contrast with the two. McCain has ads out there, and his spokespeople and surrogates on TV are saying Barack Obama is going to raise taxes. And they list six or seven taxes he's going to raise. It is true. Obama has told the truth that some taxes have to go up. He's also talking about a middle-class tax cut because he's learned the lesson that the people don't want the truth. Democrats have told the truth before. In 1984, when Ronald Reagan was running for re-election and Walter Mondale picked Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman to break the glass ceiling that Sarah Palin thinks she's breaking now, that is, being appointed as the vice presidential candidate, Mondale said explicitly, we're both going to raise your taxes, Ronald Reagan and I, after the election next year, that we have to, the way the deficits are running. The difference is I will tell you about it and he won't. Well, that was true. Ronald Reagan, the man that cut taxes in his first 4 years, looked at the numbers after he got in and agreed to what at the time was the, quote, the largest tax increase in history. We always use those phrases. Republicans love to use it against Democrats because the economy always grows. So anything time you do something, it's usually the largest in history. But Reagan did raise taxes. But the country didn't want to be told taxes were going to be raised. They wanted to be told everything's okay, I'll cut your taxes. So what Obama's planning to do is not renew the Bush tax cuts. And McCain, a year or so ago, signed up for the Bush tax cuts and said, I think we should extend the Bush tax cuts, make them permanent. Let's go back and review. George W. Bush was running for office. The projection was for something like a $2.6 to $3.3 trillion surplus over the next 5 to 10 years. I forget what it was, maybe 10 years. Now, some of that was never going to appear, but people actually wrote articles saying that we were paying down the debt too quickly. Remember that Bill Clinton, because he tightened the belt a little bit and passed a budget without the help of Republicans, but passed a budget by one vote that raised taxes, and he got lucky in the 90s with the internet economy, which, by the way, had nothing to do with Ronald Reagan. Republicans like to say that Reagan was not only responsible for his economic growth, but he can take credit for the 90s because you can't give Clinton credit for that, even though every president gets credit or blame for the economy during the years he's in, not in this case because you can't give credit to Bill Clinton. But in fact, really, Clinton was helped not just by his economic policies, but by the fact that the internet started and funded initially by the government, a government project. It was the economic engine that drove us through the 90s and gave us the economic growth that allowed us to turn around the unbalanced budgets that had peaked in the late Reagan, early Bush 41 years, and in the first year of Clinton. They turned that around. By the time Clinton was leaving office, we were running a surplus, and we were starting to pay down the national debt, which had grown to like $7 trillion, or maybe it was headed to $7 trillion. Anyway, they got it down to about $5 trillion, and people were actually saying, if we're predicting a $3 trillion surplus, they said, you know, if we pay down too much of this debt, it could be bad for the economy. And I'm thinking, are you nuts? You're saying if we get it down to $2 trillion instead of $5 trillion, somehow that's bad for the economy? Stop it. I want my Visa bill zero every month because I don't want to pay interest. Do you know we're paying over $200 billion a year in interest right off the top of our budget? That is unconscionable. My mother taught me not to pay interest on loans. Pay them off as quick as you can. I mean, if you got a 30-year mortgage at a low rate, yeah, you keep that one. But you don't keep a car loan at a high rate of interest. You don't keep a credit card at 18% and start making payments on that. You pay that off every month. So George W. Bush used as his reason for the tax cuts the fact we had this big surplus. I believe the exact quote was, "It's your money. You paid for it." So he was going to give it back to the people. Then when we started to look like we were going to have a recession, he actually talked the economy down and claimed it was a recession. We were headed for a recession before he took office, which a president never does that. He's always supposed to be rosy on the economy. You don't want a psychological issue, but he didn't want to get blamed for it. He wanted to blame it on Clinton. And once we had an economy, he said, we need the tax cuts to stimulate the economy, get growth going. Well, you might use $50 billion, you might even use $150 billion to stimulate the economy. You do not need $2.3 trillion to stimulate the economy. That's a lot of stimulation. That's like shock therapy. So George W. Bush had a series of three tax cuts 3 years in a row to the tune of approximately $2.3 trillion. Keep in mind, a billion is 1,000 million, and a trillion is 1,000 billion. Got it? So a trillion is $1 million. That's a lot of money. Okay, so Bush gives back $2.3 trillion. But get this, we're in a recession, but they're back loaded. Only a little bit was up front. They were all in the out years so that you didn't have to deal with the impact on the economy right away. And they were set to expire in 10 years because the outlook for the country's finances was so terrible, he couldn't have got them passed if he didn't agree that they would sunset, that they would stop after 10 years. And they figured, all right, we'll take this for now, and we'll harp on it later. And they started doing it within 3 years, saying that we've got to make those tax cuts permanent. After 10 years, you can't raise people's taxes. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, that's not a tax increase. That is stopping a cut that had been given temporarily. In the same way that, if you remember when the Clinton administration argued against the Republicans that you're cutting certain programs, they said, no, we're just slowing down the rate of growth. That argument works when you want it to work, and you ignore it when you don't want it to work. That's the problem with politics, the problem with both Republicans and Democrats. Let me stop on that rant and give you just a little bit more of David Byrne, who's playing in Baltimore on Wednesday night. This is from his new album with Brian Eno. And we'll be back on the Andy Finn Show on WEBR in a minute.
ocean. I watched it melt.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we are in the last segment here on September 15th. And I left off talking a little bit about the McCain versus the Obama campaign and where we're at on the issue of taxes. So McCain has signed up for the Bush tax cuts. Now, I mean, for making them permanent. Now, the problem with making them permanent is there's red ink as far as the eye can see. We are talking about over a period of, I don't know if it's about 10 more years, $3.3 trillion in debt. Now, we are currently going to run about a $500 billion deficit this year. Let's put this in perspective. When George W. Bush came into office, Clinton was running a surplus. First surplus we'd seen in 20 or 30 years. We were starting to pay down the debt. Bush said, we can't be doing that. We got to give that money back to the taxpayers. Well, that is the easiest way to get elected, to say, I'll give you money. Okay, it's one of the reasons Sarah Palin is so popular in Alaska. Did you know that in Alaska, that oil economy generates so much revenue that the state cuts a check to every citizen? You could have a four-month-old baby, and they cut that baby a check for $1,200 this year. So a family of seven, two parents and five kids, they get seven checks of $1,200 each from the state out of the oil revenue, right? And taxes are relatively low up there. That's an easy way to govern, if you ask me. Most states aren't in that boat, and certainly the federal government isn't. But George W. Bush came into office and said, I'll give you free money, vote for me. That is the easiest thing to do. Now, Republicans like to think they're fiscally conservative, but in fact, Bush didn't propose spending cuts to offset that. He said he would, but they never give specifics. And the reason they don't give specifics, because if you say you're going to cut spending, someone's ox is going to get gored and you're going to lose votes. So the Republican approach, both in the 80s under Reagan and the aughts under Bush, has been described as starve the beast. The idea is we are going to do the popular thing, which is cut taxes. We don't have the gumption. We don't have the integrity to cut spending. That would be too hard to do. So we are going to starve the government by driving up deficits. The next person who comes in will have to deal with it, and they won't be able to spend money. So it'll rein in government. Let someone else worry about it later. And George W. Bush not only lined up $2.3 trillion in tax cuts, the war in Iraq has been costing us about $10 billion a month for quite some time now. We're charging that to our grandchildren as well. It's the first war we've ever run that we didn't raise a tax to pay for it and ask people to sacrifice. We haven't been asked to sacrifice during this war. We're told it's free. That's currently the Republican approach. You know, this idea that they are these tough, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, suck it up and get the job done party, fiscally conservative. No. They're spending money that they don't have. They're giving revenue back that should be used to pay our bills. And instead, they're running up deficits and saying that your children's children will pay for all this. So it has to stop at some point. And basically what we've got is the tax cuts of the 80s driving up the deficit and driving the national debt higher. The tax cuts of 2001, 2002, 2003 driving up the deficits. By the time Bush ran in 2004, his claim to fame was, I will cut the deficit in half by the time I leave office, you know, within 4 years. And I'm thinking, what deficit? We didn't have a deficit when you came into office, buddy. And, of course, they want to blame 9/11 and the downturn, the tech bubble burst. But, of course, $2.3 trillion in tax cuts will drive a wedge in that. And the other interesting thing about this, the Republican approach to this. They always argue that if you raise taxes, it'll hurt the economy, and if you cut taxes, it'll help the economy grow. So we just had a stimulus package last year, in the last year, of about $150 billion, I think it ended up being. No, maybe it was less than that. I forget the exact amount. And, you know, we got a $600 check when we with our tax return or after our tax return this April. And that's money in the consumer's pocket to try and stave off a recession. But you have to ask yourself, and if you haven't, you should. Wait a minute. Think about the Bush tax cuts. They were backloaded over a 10-year period. We didn't see much of them. They were passed in 2001, the first one, the first $1.7 billion or something, was passed in 2001 and phased in over 10 years. Backloaded, meaning the last 5 years, particularly the last three, we should see the major effect of them. That is, most of the $2.3 billion tax cuts should come in the last 5 years, which would be 2006 to 2011. We're in the middle of that cycle right now. The Bush tax cuts should be bailing out the economy right now, but they're not. And the question is, how much worse could it possibly have been if he hadn't given away the store and if he'd paid down the debt or if he'd paid for his war? So I lay a lot of this at the feet of the Republicans. Not that they're responsible for every recession and they're responsible for the economic fallout from Katrina and Ike and 9/11 and everything. No, of course not. But that their attitude is irresponsible. They do the easy thing. They give tax cuts. And if the Democrats are the party of tax and spend, which Republicans have been saying most of my life, at least the Democrats have the guts to tax people for what the Democrats want to spend. The Republicans are the party of borrow and spend. And your children and your children's children can pay for what we want to spend. I've just never seen anything like it. So here we have John McCain coming in saying, I'm a reformer. I will clean up this mess. I know the Republicans have been in power for 8 years, and at the Republican convention, it was strange, almost surreal, to see him scolding his party and saying, we came to Washington to change Washington, and Washington changed us. And it's true. Tom DeLay set up Congress and talked to K Street, the lobbyists, and said, look, there's a new game in town, and it's Republican, and all you lobbying firms better hire Republican operatives, because that's the only way you're going to get access to the halls of power. Now, McCain says he's going to change that system, but it's laid at the doorstep of Republicans largely. Now, the Democrats weren't able to compete in money. If you remember just 8 years ago, Republicans were far outraising Democrats when it came to fundraising. And so the Democrats said, nothing doing, I've had enough of this. And they went after the K Street money, too. And they went after corporate money and lobbying money. And now they are as much beholden to big business as Republicans. Now, Obama's raising so much money now because he's also got the internet and 2.5 million people have given him money. I think that's the number. He set a new record. I think he raised $61 or $66 million in August. So it's the reason that Ralph Nader's running again. And he's polling at 2%, but that was enough to sink Al Gore in 2000. But Nader's position is there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. They're both at the corporate trough feeding. That's what I object to, so I'm running for president. Never mind that, you know, he's a liberal and would prefer to see the Democrats' approach to domestic policy, foreign policy. He's willing to make a statement, and it could cost Obama the election. By the same token, Bob Barr is running as the Libertarian candidate. He was one of the impeachment managers in the House. He lost his seat. I think he was in Georgia. But he is taking what he considers a principal stand, like Nader, against his Republican colleagues because he's a Libertarian. And he's polling at about 1.5%, 1.3%. So the question is, which of those guys will hang on to some of those votes? And will it hurt McCain or will it hurt Obama in the long run? We'll see about all that. But when it comes to the economy. The idea, I mean, basically what McCain is saying with his whole reform agenda is, yes, it's true that we must throw the bums out and put me in there instead. So he's basically saying the Republicans, the party in power are Republicans, and yes, they've screwed up, but you should vote for Republicans. We can fix it. I like the analogy John Stewart ran past Bill Kristol on his show about 4 years ago when regarding the Iraq War, when the Stewart asked him, you know, how can you push George W. Bush for re-election with the mess we've got? And Kristol made his case, and then John Stewart said, you know, it seems to me that if you're on a bus, we're all on a bus, and the bus driver drives the bus into the ditch, and then you're going to hold a vote to see who gets to get the bus out of the ditch, you don't really listen to the bus driver when he says, I'm best qualified to get us out of the ditch. No, you got us in the ditch. So as far as I'm concerned, the same is true here with McCain trying to put on the mantle of change, the mantle of reformer, and claim that he will somehow be different from all the other Republicans. Obama's got an ad out now pointing out that McCain, his top seven advisors are all lobbyists, or now former lobbyists, because they've taken leave of their senses, leaves from the company. But, you know, some of them were foreign lobbyists. They're working for Georgia. They're working for different countries. They're working for some rather unsavory operations. Now, it's true, Obama's got a couple former lobbyists on his payroll as well. But this idea that McCain's going to come in and somehow he's not beholden to anybody, we'll see about all that. In any case, we've come to the end of another edition of the Andy Finn Show. You can listen to these shows on my website and read my blog writings there at andyfinn.us. That is andyfinn.us. Or be back here on WEBR next Monday night for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. Until then, you got Midnight Mutants coming next with Adam. Do it. Don't doubt it.